And I will not abuse names of who said it. The legislator testified that there is no fixed method of allocation of educational foundation funds. An excerpt from the legislator's testimony from Wagstaff's document, and this is what's been filed in front of the court, to the question, how was it divided up as a majority was concerned? Answer, Anchorage received about 40%. I don't recall just exactly how the rest of it was divided up. Question, who made that determination? Answer, we agreed on it in caucus as a fair way to divide it up based on population needs and other programs. Question, did you know that there were some representatives who did not get any funds with which to allocate for capital projects? I'm not certain. Perhaps Blank didn't receive any. I'm not certain whether she did or didn't. She may not have received any from the House. And why was that? She, right very close to the end of the session, left the House majority. And it's my recollection, her capital was reallocated to other areas, but I'm not too clear on just how that happened. I understand at the time, her Senate counterpart procured her needs so there wasn't, it was adjusted in another place, the total budget. Another senator also testified. He gave an example of the procedure used when he attempted to secure financing of a school computer project. Question. Now, this funding of computer projects for several schools that you mentioned, what did that entail or what was involved in that? Answer. I think most of that or all of that was vetoed by Governor Sheffield. What it entailed was some consultation with the school districts and citizens to try to promote computer literacy in the schools. And I'm sure in my case, I was attending mostly in this regard to schools in District Blank, which I represent. Question. Was there any kind of study done, to your knowledge, on the necessity or desirability of the funding for computer literacy? Answer, well, I'm sure there has been studies, but we didn't contract for them, nor do I necessarily believe, and I shouldn't be more, should be more emphatic than that, I don't believe that I had them at my hand on my own reference. Question, how would you determine which schools would get them? Well, frankly, in that instance, I think most of the schools that would get there would be schools educating children whose parents are constituents of mine, and then I would expect that in some future date, if the world turns and somebody else gets up to the line.
I certainly agree with one thing you said, and that's we don't have any taxing power. Dependent on everybody. This time I'd like to expedite things right along and not make any comments.
Thank you.
Bill. Can't go through that. And I know where Representative Curtis stands, but I got to do is figure out where Senator Gillen stands. Bill Thompson, who's Director of Management, Law, and Finance, is next on the docket, and we'll proceed with that. Bill, you want to be there or come up here?
I represent the bureaucracy. We've got channels from all sides. Basically, what we are is an information agency. Sometimes, and I think that point that Senator Gilman made is that sometimes we do not put forth the best information to the legislature as we gather data from the school district. I'd like to briefly mention the capital priority system, because we certainly can check out on that. I have one gentleman who's very good, who this year had to be prioritized some 330 projects of requests that totaled about $700 million. At the state's budget cycle, it's approximately 6 weeks from the time the request comes in to be able to evaluate this. And secondly, it is a priority system that somebody has to be on the top and somebody has to be on the bottom. You see, what's fair, my definition of what is fair is that your ox gets gored more than mine does. We One of the things I think I'm hearing here, because I'm not going to talk a lot about e-technics and school finance, I think there's a couple of points that I want to make. One, education, and tying in with what Dr. Jorgensen said, education is used in this country to do a lot of things. A lot of social public policy is carried out through the educational mechanism. It may not be related to the direct activity of children. Give you an example. 1968, became public policy to electrify rural Alaska, the vehicle used schools. 1974, the legislation was passed in 72. Let's put water and sewer in a lot of communities. The Village Safe Water Act, the vehicle used to finance the operation, schools. Therefore, when we take a look at what an educational finance program, we can only look at one issue of the foundation program. We have to look at also what is the relationships of some of these things that may be used as part of the accompanying legislation to carry out public policy. For this reason, on Wednesday, we have the statewide policy group that represents all the constituent groups and the legislature, the office management budget. And they identified some 26 issues of which they felt there needed to be analyzed before any distribution program. Basically, those go down into four categories. One, governance. And the big issue there, I think, is state and local control issue. What is that relationship? You know, there is still a lot of truth, and I hear that when I hear legislators speak. And that is, the man who has the goal makes the rules. What is that relationship that the state, since it has a constitutional mandate for education, can assure itself as a state that the dollars put into education for the benefit of children are effective? Second area is programming instruction. That's the second category. And that deals with those issues. Is there, for example, a minimum size school or a minimum number of children before you have a school? Right now, the law says that there'll be 8 elementary children, and the district is required to provide schools. Is that adequate? Should it be 6? Should it be 20? Should it be another number? Third, there's the auxiliary services, capital outlay, maintenance and operation plan. Auxiliary services, people transportation, one of my favorite subjects, food service. What is, if you have two methods in capital outlay, what is expected to be funded from the operation and maintenance of plant that's included in a formula of some sort, and what should be funded through another mechanism, cash, bonded, or whatever. And the fourth one is revenue. There's three sources, federal, state, local. There's a traditional source of raising revenue, like property tax, for example, at the local level. And we know what it is at the state. It's Prudhoe Bay. What happens in the future? Not only when you look at revenue as to what you want to pay for, but it's also what can you afford to pay? We know that Prudhoe Bay is being pumped faster in any field. It's a gigantic field. But it's like anything. All things are finite almost and come to an end. What happens then? Is the things that we've identified and put together for presentation to the next legislature, will that be adequate 4 years down the road or 5 years or whatever? It won't if the revenue is not there to what we've identified. Or if the revenue drops, what do you cut out? And we're talking about things of minimum educational service level. And then we talk about something above that, if that's appropriate. And appropriate is political. And political is, what do you want to pay for as a group? And we all have our individual ideas. Finally, we will have, when we get to the distribution scheme, this committee will serve as a committee as a whole. And hopefully, that we will have consensus, although there will be a lot of compromises, and everybody will not get everything that they wish, that next January, we'll have a good, solid program. Finally, I would like to just speak a little bit about capital outlay. There's so many mechanisms now that there is request through the Department of Education, there is debt service, and there's municipal grants. Senator Gelman alluded to a school in which the department changed his mind.
I changed the department's mind, is what I
mean. You're correct. And you, for example, if is treating fairly under capital, meaning that everybody gets whatever they presented, even though it may be in no relationship to what really is needed. And if the department, see, it's very interesting, I find. For, I'll give you a specific example. Last year, I was not with the department. But what they, the first $11.5 million worth of the highest priorities in the state were unfunded, as identified by the department. It makes it very difficult to go through the amount of work that it takes to prioritize and to try to treat people fairly. And you see, districts that do not have any other avenue, first of all, they have no political base, or do not have to have a political base, but they do not have a strong member of the legislature in the majority position. And the result, and they ignore, also have no ability to bond locally because they have no tax base. And so they can sit year after year after year, and yet their needs are just as great. One of the ways of solving them may be that you have an amount that every school district gets every year for capital outlay. What does that do? It promotes planning. At least you're going to count on that you're going to have something, that you can take care of such things as major maintenance items. If you have a $250,000 roof to replace, and that way you know that you're going to have to replace 3 years down the pipe that you can save up for. But you cannot, and I think it's very pathetic to see certain locations get nothing year after year after year. If you do any analysis over the last 10 years, the variations, and it's not between cities and boroughs and REAAs, it's all over the place. Because there are certain REAAs, in my analysis, that haven't got any more than certain cities. Therefore, I hope as an adjunct to this foundation program study, the finance study that this year is going to be addressed. That concludes my comments.
Thank you, Bill. Glad to hear your comments about some of the districts not getting enough money. I'd like to introduce the last panelist before we open for questions and other comments, Peter McDowell. As I said earlier, the director of the Governor Sheffield's Office of the Management and Budget. We put him last because He's the one that can tell us whether or not we are going to get funded next year, and if we are, what the level's going to be, generally speaking, and can answer all of the questions. And so he is, in effect, the money man. So we didn't want him to give us a good word today or drop a bomb on us, whichever the case might be. And I'm sure after his deliberations over the last few weeks, he'd be prepared to do that.
Thanks, Gene. I hope you don't mind if I stay at the table, but I've gotten so used to being in meetings during the past year that it's hard to stand up and not have a place to put your elbows. All kinds of meetings, I'd like to add. The speakers that have preceded me have, I think, covered very eloquently the major public policy issues, and I only asked for the cleanup slot because that makes my life a lot easier, and I can probably just go through, and I hope try to make a short list of the major public policy considerations, or the conflicts, I should say, that get to the Office of the Governor and the legislature. As I've noticed in the last year, and I'm sure you're all much better aware of this than I am, that we don't get to work on the easy ones, only the ones where we have good public policy to do one thing coming into conflict with good public policy to do something else. So if I can just go back and very quickly talk about these things that over and above the hurly-burly of the session that we're about to start next month, there is study, debate, and consideration. And even though there's a lot of dust on short-term things, of longer-term issues, there is lots of good discussion that you contribute to, and a lot of intelligent research and discussion done by all of your elected representatives. And the equity of funding among Alaskan school children is never forgotten. It's there. And the governor, I can clearly state, supports the right to quality education for all the children in Alaska. So it's not an issue, it's just how do you get at it best. The issue of equity among government programs that's been raised by two or three of the speakers. The fact of the matter is education competes with public protection, it competes with economic development, it competes with other human services, it competes with transportation. And every year, the governor and the legislature get together and make a decision as to whether its share is 30, 40, or 50%. The issue of incorporation of the unorganized borough into municipalities has a dramatic effect on school funding. It's been brought up again by a couple of the speakers. Alaskan law contains a number of incentives for and a number of incentives against incorporation of the unorganized borough. On one side, there is tax base everywhere. You can't say that the unorganized borough doesn't have a tax base. Everywhere there's a home, there's a tax base. Everywhere where there's a village corporation and they develop their land into and use it and begin to earn money from it, there's a tax base. The unorganized borough is not exempt from taxation. Neither are small municipalities. They do have, the school districts don't have the power to tax, but there is a tax base out there. But in many, many places, unlike a lot of the rest of the United States, the tax base is not at its critical mass, and therefore it would be very inappropriate to encourage false hopes of incorporation on the basis that there was enough out there for the local municipality to tax. So every day and every year, I think Alaskans have a special responsibility to consider this. Another issue, an organizational issue. What is an REAA? Is it the devolution of state agency powers, or is it the rudiments of municipal government? That's a public policy issue that is addressed frequently, and I think always needs to be addressed when you're talking about funding for schools. This leads to another issue of what is the school model for Alaska? I'm hoping that the objective consultants who are working on the study can address this issue along with most of us, and we can come up with a resolution, or at least an answer that will serve us well for the rest of the 1980s. I would offer that right now we are as close to a state-operated school system in the state of Alaska as we ever have been. I've studied the history of school funding in Alaska, and I don't believe we've ever been closer than we are in 1983 to a single state system where the legislature is the assembly. I don't really believe that we've kept the distinctions between the organized and the unorganized borough very clear when it comes to school finance. So we're way over to one side of that model. We've moved away from the municipal incorporation model with local responsibility and local control of the finances for schools. When we get to the issues of the operating and capital responses to school needs, when you combine the two, you see that Alaska has developed through the foundation program an extremely sophisticated response to getting at your operating budgets. It's one of the most sophisticated in the U.S. and probably in the world. The capital response is a stepchild, an absolute stepchild compared to the way we go after the operating budget in this state. It's confused. It's probably inappropriate to say that we're going to deal with capital without thinking about operating. And I would offer that that's exactly what we do right now. We go out and appropriate capital projects for schools, and then we worry later about what it means for an operational plan. I believe that school capital funding ought to be done on the basis of an operational plan that, and it's just another way of looking at dollars that are required to accomplish those operational objectives. The final thing, and one of the things I think that has been brought out by several of the speakers, Senator Gilman, and following on the comments of Dr. Chambers, and that is that, however, that sophisticated old program that we did use until last year to meet at least the operating needs or the response to the operating needs does suffer from a few problems. It doesn't have good data to justify it. Either the fixed cost portion, which is financed through that attendance center account, it doesn't have good data to justify the area cost differentials, and it does not have good data to identify and justify total basic need or the variable portion of the funding. So the effort that's underway in these 2 years, I think, is essential and crucial to getting the data that will justify the components and elements of the cost of education in Alaska. Finally, I'd just like to make a couple of short-term observations back to today. And that today for me, of course, and I think for all of us, is the fiscal year 1985 state budget. And there are two items in the law of the land or the law of the state of Alaska that passed last session that I'd like to just remind you of again, although others have done this. The legislature last year, with the approval of the governor, put in place for fiscal year 1984 and fiscal year 1985 the intent to allow the study of the complete school funding program and put in place an interim funding solution that will allow for at least, we hope, a reasonable amount of budget for your districts in fiscal year 1984 and fiscal year 1985. And essentially that law says that 1985 should be 1984 plus inflation as measured by the January 83 to January 84 change in the Anchorage All Urban Consumers CPI. It's very specific. We've checked it out with the Department of Labor. It means exactly what it says. So the letter of the law, is probably the best indicator of the fiscal year 1985 operating budget. The capital budget, there was another law of the land that passed as well, Senate Bill 152, which was the statute that establishes the Office of Management and Budget. Included in that was a definition of a capital project. It said it must be an asset that costs more than $25,000 and has a life of more than 1 year. So I would just say that two things happened last year that set some new parameters for fiscal year 1985, and I think we can all look to them as guidelines for this coming year's budget. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
At this time, with the remaining time we have available, I'd like to open it up to questions from the floor. And if you would please just stand and address your question to one of the panel members. Or if you have a general question, we'll try to find somebody that has courage enough to answer it. Any questions you might have, concerns, issues regarding state finance, as presented by the group of varying opinions? Mr. Freeman?
I'd like to ask Mr. McDowell, for next year, if it's funding is by EDM, does that include new enrollment or just the CPI?
Could I ask Bill to address that one?
That includes enrollment increases. That includes transfer of the Bureau of Indian Affairs schools designated for next July 1 transfer. Yes, it does.
Other questions you might have? Yes, Scott?
Question, Senator Gilman, do you expect either the House or the Senate or any tax income to provide leadership in looking to other resources like sales tax or income tax to begin to make up for some of the reductions in the environment?
1984 is an election year.
Next question?
Yeah, next question. No.
Bill, I read the law to say that our foundation will be based upon our first quarter report. Some have said it's the total year report. How do you read that?
The ADM count for next year's funding is based on the first quarter revised.
Okay.
of the prior year. So it's a first quarter to first quarter report.
And okay, not a sum total of the ADM for the year, though?
No, sir.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Somebody has stated that oil productions are expected to be decreased or reduced for the coming years. Do we have any data on which we can base that projected reduction? And do we have any means by which we can verify that data?
Well, the data, without getting into a long discourse on how oil revenues are projected, the data essentially comes from the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission that is responsible for the maximum yield of the field, any field. And if you don't hold me to anywhere close to plus or minus year or something like that, somewhere in the late 80s, there is going to start to be a decline of the production of Prudhoe Bay. And of course, there are other fields that are being discovered and being brought on. The question is, whether those fields are, number one, on state land, and number two, whether the production will be sufficient to keep a steady flow. The data, in my opinion, the data the Department of Revenue has is pretty accurate. It does come from some proprietary sources, however, which is difficult for the Department of Revenue to have to be able to make that public. And the central question, though, is I guess what the central issue is, maybe then question, is that all of our eggs are in one basket. Everything we do in the state, well, I won't say everything, but much of what we do in the state is based on one factor, and that's what the price of a barrel of oil is going to be. And we don't know that, and we'll never know that from essentially one half of the year to another half of the year.
Yes.
In light of the fact that there is a study to determine the school finances, possibly to allow fair, equitable distribution of funds, I'd like to ask possibly anybody, a response from anybody, how the legislature or the governor's office the proposed funding for operating management.
Not me. Because I wouldn't fund it. But then, go ahead.
I can answer part of that. From the perspective of the governor's office, it is conceptually, he's been thinking of Mount Edgecombe as a new legislation. In fact, what we anticipate doing is going forward with a legislative proposal, which has a fiscal note attached to it in January, to be dealt with as a separate subject. That's, of course, that will be sponsored by Commissioner Reynolds.
Yes, I have a question. I failed to respond to. Has any thought been given to any internal factoring to offset the cost of this ADM of special education children and vocational kids?
When the legislature enacted House Bill 251, what they did was, in effect, freeze the foundation program and then stipulated that you shall provide the services to those children as required by law. It does not provide any mechanism for adjustment other than through the political process of adjusting an ADM for a particular district, because there is 53 of them. In other words, what they really did was when they froze it, they said, given that there is a finance study underway, at this point in time, we're treating everything as true. But there is no mechanism. This is also, I think, Niall, the question you raised on whether it was the first quarter or the first quarter. It would be potentially possible for a district to receive no money for a substantial increase if the students came in after the first quarter, left at year-end, and were, or the prior fall, prior to the first quarter count.
Those of you that are in favor of local control, well, I think we got it this year. We're not sure we want it, but we got it. Yes, Leroy, and then I'll go to Peter. Let me just, did you have an add-on to that, Peter?
I think this is defeated probably. If we assume that we're going to come up with a fair and equitable distribution system, which is going to, of course, have to go through the test of the political gamut before anything comes, isn't it somewhat irresponsible at the time that we educators are being asked to come up with a plan that there is not also some study going on to project what the income will be and what the needs are in a long-range sense? Now, getting back to the political question of income tax, or sales tax, or some other broad-based way of providing long-range support of education or human services or anything else, it seems to me that we cannot, as educators, come up with anything that's going to answer the question of how much money there's going to be there. We make an assumption, we come up with an equitable way of cutting everything in half, let's say, if we cut those down. It seems to me that the state has got to, and the legislature has got to, have a good long-range study, bite the bullet themselves about how we're going to come up with financing, and something other than oil. All I hear is all the bad talk that oil's going down. We don't know what oil's going to do 5 years from now, to be honest about it. And I don't like the talk of saying it's going to be, it isn't going to be there, and so on. We don't know. I think we've got to have a study that responsibly projects ahead and pays for continued support of education. And I guess that is a political question. Maybe it can come out of this next session that the legislature come up with a way maybe to help us deal with that.
Yeah, thanks. Just to elaborate a little bit more, I think, on some of Senator Gilman's comments as a partial response, we are, in the Office of the Governor and in the Office of Management and Budget, heavily involved in the forecasting and planning of the 80s, the remainder of the 1980s and the 90s. Governor Sheffield, as I think all of you are aware, has said that it's not going to be part of his tenure to dump the next governor off the cliff when it comes to revenues. He is committed to planning for the future and in a fiscal and a policy sense. What's going to happen out there based on current forecasts is that fiscal year 1987, and that's only 3 years from today, is the peak year in real terms for present state of Alaska oil-based revenue from existing fields, including all the Kuparuk and all of the other fields that are on state land and will be earning in the next couple of years. The decline after about 19, it's kind of levels in real terms for a couple of years, and then after 1989, it's because Prudhoe starts to drop based on current forecasts at about 15% a year in barrel terms, the revenue to the state goes with it. There is no other field, known or unknown, at this time in Alaska or anywhere near Alaska that can come close to being less, more than about a tenth of Prudhoe Bay. So if you lose 15% of Prudhoe Bay a year and you gain one field per year, you're going to make up 1.5% of it. And it's there is a sugar daddy out there, and it's a big one. And it is an important consideration. Now, what does that mean? It means alternative sources of revenue to fund important state programs, including, of course, education. It means alternative forms of development in the state of Alaska, as well as further development in the oil and gas industry that will preserve the ability of the state to serve its people. There aren't specific answers in place at this time, and I would offer that there aren't even specific proposals on the table at this stage, because we're very early into this term and very early into the process of looking forward and trying to come up with the best proposals and working with the legislatures as they occur over the next 2 or 3 years to put those proposals in place. There is concern. There is great concern. There is work going on, and I believe that I can't say that I believe this administration will answer all of the questions, but it's making a real effort and a real try at doing the best possible during the time we have.
Jay, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify a point, or perhaps emphasize a point I tried to make in my remarks, and it relates to what Leroy just stated, and I must say that the consultants support wholeheartedly that you do need to begin to develop the definition of basic education in the context of available revenues. And in fact, I heard in a couple of comments of the panelists and in remarks in some of the questions I'm concerned that, again, basic education is being bandied about as if it's some objective concept that's going to be defined independently of the availability of resources and of the alternative uses to which the funds could be expended. Basic education can only be defined within the context of available resources. We're not going to come out with a cost model that's going to cost things out and say, this is what a basic education is, because you may not be able to afford what you initially defined, which means you haven't defined an adequate or an appropriate education in the context of your own economic circumstances. And until you do that, you know, need and scarcity have to be in sync with one another.
Other questions or comments? We have maybe one or time for one or two more.
I'd just like to comment that previous legislatures did look at the Pluto Bay with a one-time fine, and a permanent fund was conceived of at least as incremental addition to the future income of the state, and that's one of the reasons why the battle over how the fund is going to be used or whether it's going to be preserved for the time when the oil revenue comes down. Also, in the general press, I noticed there's a, shall we say, an obfuscation of the point that we're essentially selling oil. We're in the business of selling oil from state land. Just oil development doesn't mean additional income. Offshore oil on federal land will mean increased cost to Alaska without any necessary increase to the state, because it will be on federal land and the feds will be selling it. So, you know, we have to look at all of these things in different contexts. It isn't only, there are no simple answers, and we may be drawn to other solutions.
Yes, sir?
Somewhat along the same line. Mr. McDowell made a statement that we're probably as close today to being a state school system as we've ever been. And I can recall about 22 years ago, in a similar symposium to this in the state of Oregon, where the Oregon legislature was going to provide a lot more funding to schools, but they were going to say to them what they could do, not only in the use of that money, but also to use the other resources that were available. And essentially, the question is, if we're going to have a state school system, is the state going to say that we can't spend our own money on our own kids? If a school system has a tax base that supplements whatever comes from the school, is the state ever going to be in a position of saying you can't spend your own money on your own kids?
Thank you. I'll do the rest of it. Well, one final question. Yes, ma'am.
Well, this may not be appropriate, but I'm just thinking there is one state that has a state school system. That's Hawaii. And I just wondered if anyone had looked to see what problems that had in the funding and why.
I haven't done any major research in the Raya school system. It's difficult to do that from the palm trees and the beach, but I do have some friends that have lived here and have moved to Hawaii. And the major criticism there is the local people have nothing to say about their schools.
Yes, and each quarter, as a member of the Northwest Regional Educational Laboratory Board of Directors, I meet with one of the representatives from Hawaii. And I would say just, and maybe it's an oversimplification, but Senator Gilman is exactly correct, and they have substantially greater problems trying to operate a school system over there than we do, because their superintendent of schools or commissioner is essentially an operating superintendent. They don't make local decisions, period. Let me wrap this up and say that I want to appreciate your cooperation and patience. You stayed from 2:15 to almost 5 with a 5-minute break. And I guess what that means is that tough issues and tough questions require tough people. And you're tough enough to stand, to sit here, I should say, and listen to the various options and presentations by the panel. I want to thank you. And last but not least, I want to thank the panel members for taking their time and being with us today. It is a very important issue. We look forward to seeing all of you here again tomorrow for the wrap-up session and helping us find solutions to the questions. Thank you very much.